Remember, last time we met, the plan was to not quite complete the section on marriage, divorce, and celibacy, but continue in this class. However, in the meantime, I have given you 2 pages of a chart on the following chapter in your textbook, namely on the church and state relations. What I want you to do now is to continue and finish up on marriage, celibacy, and divorce. The 2 charts, I hope you have them. I believe we were talking about under civil authority in our 2-page chart on this subject. And at the top of page 2 of the 2nd chart, number 4, under civil authority, what were the arguments used by those who call themselves the reformers? They claim that you must reinterpret Christ's words, "Except it be for adultery." The Catholic Church had never interpreted those words of Christ to mean that you may both separate from your spouse and remarry. Separate, yes, as we teach priests, infidelity in marriage is sufficient grounds. We have a lifelong separation, as the expression goes, from bed and board, but never with a right to remarry. A more popular, and I would say universal, appeal to marriage after divorce was, and no exceptions, all the founders of Protestantism, without exception, appealed to the Old Testament. And over the years, in teachings I've told you in 6 Protestant seminaries, having 9 graduate courses in Protestantism that I've taught over the years, 3 published books in Protestantism, having spoken in so many Protestant churches, the single principal divergence between Catholicism and Protestantism is that the Catholic Church believes that Christ restored marriage to its condition before the fall. Whereas Protestantism, I repeat, no exception. Protestantism holds that the condition in the Old Testament, with the permission, if you wish, of divorcing and remarrying, as was surely the practice under the Mosaic law, is still the law in Christianity. Over the years, I've told hundreds of students, and how many audiences, in one single sentence, the main difference between Catholicism and Protestantism is that Catholicism is New Testament Christianity, and Protestantism is Old Testament Christianity. Here we could talk for hours, in fact days. Now behind that cosmic difference is what we as Catholics firmly, clearly, unqualifyingly believe, that Jesus Christ was and is the Son of God who became the Son of Mary. In other words, that Jesus Christ is God, and therefore he had a right, to put it mildly, to change the Mosaic moral law. Not by doing away with it, but by elevating it, or more accurately for our purpose, by restoring it to the condition of man before the human race fell. Divorce with remarriage, polygamy, and all protected by all the state authorities in human history. There has never been a religion in the Old Testament, never any religion which prescribed monogamy. Never. Zero. There is not now any religion in the world that requires monogamy. One man, one woman, faithful to each other until death. Except Christianity, or as we're finding out, within Christianity, only those that are Roman Catholic Christians. And even within Roman Catholic Christians, only those who are not only Roman Catholics in name, but in reality. That's why the future of the Catholic Church in the United States is in grave jeopardy of being dissolved. As I think I've told you, a member of the Roman Rota, which handles the annulment cases in the United States that are questioned, in other words, appealed to Rome for a possible reversal of the diocesan decision, as he told me, our biggest problem in the United States is that so many, including bishops, who no longer believe that a valid sacramental consummated marriage cannot be dissolved by any human authority. Once you've got millions of nominal Catholics no longer believing that, it's not just that so many marriages are, quote, annulled. It's the reason why 42 churches closed in Detroit and 62 in Chicago. The Catholic faith will survive only among those who still believe in Christ's teaching on the absolute indissolubility, I repeat, of a legal, better, of a valid sacramental consummated marriage. Then, of course, the argument from practical impossibility. Well, sure. Remember, even Christ's disciples, when he told the Pharisees, only two in one flesh. Then remember, the disciples asked the Master. Seems to us, Lord, and he was sincere. Seems to us, Lord, better not marry. Then Christ matched that statement. So you're telling me better not marry. My dear friends, let me tell you something. You may be shocked to hear this. Better not marry. The grace that I am offering my followers includes even the grace for some of them not to marry. And if you're not going to marry and be happy, you better have a lot of grace, superhuman grace. That's why Christ instituted the sacrament of matrimony. Marital indissolubility is an ideal. One moral, nominally Catholic theologian after another. It's an ideal. No. It is a premise of the Catholic faith. Marital indissolubility can be enforced by the state. Oh, so what? Whose laws are we talking about? Christ's laws or the state laws? Heavy moral pressure has a consequence on believing Catholics. Very heavy. Problems arising from mixed marriages, which I told you we had a booklet available. I'd recommend getting a copy. The present average in the United States is over 50% of marriages in this Catholic center are mixed marriages. I think I quoted to you the German hierarchy. The German bishops pleaded, warned their Catholic people, please, do not enter into mixed marriage. And they gave the figure, this is the German hierarchy. By the third generation, all the children of mixed marriages are lost to the Catholic faith. And it's not just in Germany, but in every country. Because when you have a mixed marriage, first of all, between husband and wife, and as I've said so often, only the Catholic Church believes that a marriage cannot be dissolved. A Catholic marries a Protestant, and the Protestant makes all kinds of promises, signs all sorts of papers, swears, this is a marriage until death do us part. But years and years of training and indoctrination, they enter marriage, and by now, all the books, three stout volumes I could write on the problems of mixed marriages within weeks of the marriage. They now maybe even have converted into Catholicism, but not trained in the faith. We're going to use contraceptives. She's a woman, tells her husband, she's taking the pill. So, mixed marriages create huge problems. And faith in a lifelong commitment, a condition for valid marriage, it just is a fact. I taught them. I know them. I've taught their ministers. I've sat as one of the examiners for a final examination for a Protestant minister getting his doctorate in theology. I was on the board examining him. I know what they believe. I know what they think. The real test of being an authentic Catholic is believing, even unto death, believing that marriage with the conditions we qualified, valid contract, sacramental, and consummated, no pope can dissolve. Widespread practice on granting annulments. Again, for our next class, today is the 29th. Our next class is November the
12th.
November the 12th. November the 12th. So, by November the 12th, I'll bring at least some facts about annulments that I think we should all know. One dies as after another. And, as I've told you, I've talked to the tribunals of these dioceses. What grounds do you have for giving these annulments? And I repeat, they tell me, everyone who applies for annulment has a right to one. That's the end of the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church will survive only where? In those dioceses, in those parishes, and those families where husband and wife still believe what we're talking about the absolute indissolubility of marriage. Now something about celibacy and evangelical chastity. Logical opposition to celibacy and consecrated chastity among the founders of Protestantism. And it is well to know that Protestantism began because a Catholic priest who had taken solemn vows as an Augustinian to consecrate a chastity was unfaithful. Over the years, I've told people, save your time, spare your trouble of reading the 54 volumes of Martin Luther. It's a waste of time. The reason for Protestantism is in one word, as a monosyllable, three letters, sex. Luther was convinced he could not control his sex passions. And he couldn't. Because what did he do? He stopped praying. Any priest who stops praying is going to have big problems with sex. Any nun, any religious who stops praying, same problem. That's why we've lost over 80,000 nuns in the United States. And over 8,000 priests. Now behind the exclusion of both a celibate life and consecrated chastity was a series of premises, beginning, I repeat, with Martin Luther. The doctrine on human depravity. According to Luther, man is not only a sinner. Let me give you the Latin, because Luther wrote in Latin, also in German, but his main writings were in Latin. Homo est, that's Latin, and Luther. Homo est, non solum peccator. homo est peccatum. Man is not only a sinner, man is sin. Homo est peccatum. Direct quotation from the Reverend Martin Luther. Once you believe that our human nature is depraved, and that's the language, natura humana est depravata. Not merely deprived, but depraved. It is therefore incapable of controlling, in this case, the sex passions. Moreover, the original reformers, as they call themselves, rejected the supernatural life. Luther never believed, pardon me, once he lost his faith. And once you lose your Catholic faith, let me tell you, you lose much more than most people think. I don't hesitate saying you lose your sanity. For Luther and his followers, therefore, we come into this world not merely without sanctifying grace. We never had sanctifying grace. There is no such thing as sanctifying grace in Protestant theology. One of my students, the Lutheran School of Theology, in answer to one of my questions, would say there is sanctifying grace. Well, it depends on what I would ask him. If I asked him whether you believed in sanctifying grace, oh, I am happy. When they told me that Protestants believe in sanctifying grace, he'd flunk. In other words, our nature is depraved. It has lost its power even to control. That's why denial of true internal freedom years and years that I've taught the theology of divine grace, and just to very briefly a sliver repeat to yourselves, once you deny, as the so-called reformers all denied, there is such a thing as a supernatural life. Well then, what happened when man fell? If he couldn't lose supernatural life, since he didn't have it in the first place, what happened? Hear it. Human nature lost. What? Every human being possesses. So we think. Human beings lost what? They lost their freedom. That's another phrase for original sin in Protestant theology. The loss of freedom. That's why American prisons are filled to overflowing. You don't believe in freedom, why should you put anybody in jail? They cannot help doing what they're doing. Then, reinterpretation of St. Paul's teaching on virginity. You cannot imagine what Luther and his followers did to the New Testament to make it fit their teaching. They shaped the Bible to change, to fit their own ideas. Well, somebody asked Martin Luther, Martin, Why did you put the adverb, the German adverb, allein, A-double-L-E-I-N, into the letters of St. Paul, that man is faith saved by faith? That's St. Paul. And Martin Luther put in, man is saved by faith alein, by faith alone. Luther's answer, St. Paul was inspired by the Holy Spirit, so am I. Then, alleged reasons for celibacy: to keep the priesthood from becoming a hereditary caste. Isn't that neat? So the Catholic Church invented celibacy to keep the priesthood hereditary. Again, that celibacy is also required in marriage. So in other words, why burden people with the impossible? It's hard enough to remain faithful in marriage. Don't lay impossible burdens on men's shoulders. And the breach of celibacy by Luther, Cranmer, Bucer, Zwingli, and Knox, I just thought I'd stop the line. Every single cleric who in the 16th century, no exceptions, who became Protestant, broke his vow of celibacy. Do you still hear me? And I'll tell people, the libraries of the world, libraries of the world, are filled with volumes defending the immoral behavior of their writers. That's why some people write books, to defend their misbehavior. Denial of good works or merit. Once you deny that you've got a free will, without a free will you cannot merit. Then obviously, to speak of celibacy as pleasing to God is more than nonsense. It's blasphemy. Hard enough to remain faithful in marriage. Oh, pardon me. Pardon me. I'm talking like a Catholic. I forgot. You don't have to remain faithful in marriage. Do you hear me? As Protestants, you don't have to. Church's tradition in praise of virginity over the centuries. And as you know, the praise is because God does give some people, and I tell the people, be sure you know some people, the grace to live a lifetime of celibacy. Well, you better have the grace. You better, underline, capitalize, better have the grace. Historic evidence of the blessings of consecrated chastity in the lives of the saints and their apostolic achievement. Listen to this. Hope you've heard it somewhere. Mahatma Gandhi was no Christian. He was a Hindu until his death. But our own Jesuits in India spent years Christianizing Mahatma as much as they could. They thought it had him become a Christian. They never succeeded. But Gandhi knew a lot about Christianity. think I told you. He always carried two books with him, the New Testament and the Imitation of Christ, Mahatma Gandhi. For the last 20 years of Gandhi's life, he and his wife agreed to sacrifice marital relations. That's a fact of history. In order to give him, as he believed, both the freedom and the strength to carry out what he did in liberating his country. Find the promotion of consecrated chastity in the Anglican religious communities. In the middle of the 19th century, the Anglicans, who had no dogma to speak of for centuries since Henry VIII, and they sure had no religious communities, Cardinal Newman did wonders for the Anglican world. We now distinguish among the Anglicans the high and low church. Among the high church Anglicans, there are, I would say, at least 25 religious communities of both men and women who bind themselves to a lifetime of consecrated chastity. In other words, these high Anglicans believe in the seven sacraments, and they also believe in Christ's teaching, both on marital indissolubility and celibacy. And so far, on marriage. I trust there will be enough questions when we get to the question period. And now, you have your two pages on church and state relations. Do you all have them? Remember, that's the next chapter in your textbook. Oh, pardon me. It's 3:17. Till what time do we go? 4:30. Now we go with the class till 4:15 is scheduled time, but 3:40. Let's make it say to 3:45. Then we'll pick up your questions, okay? First, by way of prelude, there is no more important aspect of Protestantism that we Catholics should understand than to see what the Protestant churches have done to create what we call state religions. American culture cannot be understood without knowing how radically Protestantism has affected church and state relations in our country. All our laws in the United States are of Protestant ancestry. All of them, question, all of them. We go on. Two basic principles introduced by Protestantism. And they've changed the whole world. First, the affirmation of the universal priesthood of the laity and the denial of a real distinction between the ecclesiastical and the secular, you might add, authority. What is the first thing, the fundamental thing, which Protestantism introduced into the Western world? The claim of the universal priesthood of the laity. In other words, the distinction between the sacred and the profane was erased by Protestantism. As Catholics, we believe, and we change that, as Catholics, we who still have the full Catholic faith believe that there are persons on earth who are divinely ordained, ordained by Christ Himself, that there is a priesthood. And the priesthood is no mere ministry. It is not just that someone in authority sets aside certain people to minister to the people's needs. Oh no. When a man is ordained, he is changed. Changed in his very nature. In other words, he becomes, and now he may not sat to say always behave as he should, but he becomes a sacred person. And secondly, the Protestants, without exception, deny the real distinction between the ecclesiastical and the secular on three levels, in terms of authority, in terms of the state, and in terms of institutions. In Protestantism, hear it, there is no authority on earth. There is no authority on earth which does not belong to the state. At the heart, at the core of Protestantism is the denial of ecclesiastical authority. And therefore, there is only the state. The state is the only authority visibly on earth. The alleged authority of the church is an intrusion. And correspondingly, institutions. That's why how I am pained to say it. That's why most of our once Catholic institutions of learning, most of our once Catholic hospitals are no longer Catholic. Protestantism has just taken over. And my 26th year in working for the Holy See, I've seen one once flourishing religious institute in the Archdiocese of Detroit, one community, 31 parish schools, informed that spring, Cardinal Dearden, and they paid him the courtesy of listing all the Catholic schools which they were leaving that year. And what I now have, what I'm calling a study in an empty convent, what I call my office, in an empty Catholic school. But let's be clear, it's not how much I say, that's not important. It's how clear the ideas that are true, not because I say them. In other words, Protestantism denied past tense, denies present tense, and will continue to deny future tense on principle the existence of any visible authority on earth except the civil authority of the state. And that philosophy has done demonic wonders in our country, practically wiped out our Catholic school system. Now some of the political ideas of the Protestant founders. Founders of what? First of all, of Protestantism, and then of those who were founders of our own nation, or the same could be said of other countries. Denial that the church has authority over the state. Which is just the opposite of why, for 300 years, at the dawn of Christianity, hundreds of thousands of martyrs shed their blood. All they were told, nothing else, just a little grain of incense, there was burning charcoal. All they had to do was line up and drop a grain of incense in front of a statue of Jupiter. That's all. Jupiter being the god of the state. Those who refused were thrown to the lions, burned to death, and beheaded. And what Christ said, oh, remember these words, when he was asked, remember, by the Pharisees, is it lawful to pay tribute to Caesar? Should we pay our taxes? Remember Christ's answer. First he looked at a coin. Whose image is this? Caesar's. And then he said, give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar. Why be sure you give to God what belongs to God? What have so many Catholics in our country been doing? Giving to Caesar what belongs to God. In other words, as Catholics, we believe that the state has no right to take the legalization of contraception as a state law. The church says contraception is wrong. Who's right? Oh, now 50 of our states have legalized abortion. Civil authority says it's legal. And when I was in Texas, I was warned. I told you, two buildings next to each other and with one staircase, You got to the top of the staircase, you turn in one direction, that was the abortion clinic. Turn the other direction, and that's the, well, the Catholic offices for protesting abortion. And I was told, Father, watch yourself. Don't ring the wrong doorbell, otherwise you will be immediately arrested. You protect human life, you're a criminal. You murder innocent human life, and you're a hero. And we Catholics, like butterflies, allow ourselves to be moved and shaped. When in 1973, Supreme Court